This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Every now and then, there's a game-changing scientific paper about climate change. I saw this one and right away invited our next guest. Catherine Rickey, known as Kate, joined well-known scientist Ken Caldera to investigate a critical question. How long does it take the carbon we emit today to reach its peak heating potential? If you answered 50 years or more, you're in for a shock. The title of the new paper is a giveaway. Maximum warming occurs about one decade after a carbon dioxide emission. That was published December 2, 2014, in the journal Environmental Research Letters. The lead author is Catherine Rickey, a postdoctoral researcher at the Carnegie Institute for Science at Stanford University in California. Kate, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, your study's kind of a bombshell. We've been told for years that carbon emissions will really impact our children or our grandchildren, not us. How did you find the peak heating is only 10 years after emission?
Well, we actually used the same models and modeling results that people have been using to make the best possible projections for how the climate will change under various emission scenarios going forward. It's just that no one had ever bothered to take the results from these model ensembles before and do this analysis of what the effect of an individual emission that someone makes today is. And when we combined the results from these modeling ensembles to do this analysis, we were pretty surprised because we weren't expecting the time until the maximum effect to be just 10 years.
And I want to go into that paper further, but I guess an obvious question from a non-scientist would be, why does a puff of carbon take 10 years to become active in trapping heat radiation? Why doesn't it have its maximum impact as soon as it goes up into the atmosphere?
It's because it takes a while for the oceans to warm up. If you think about the atmosphere like a shallow frying pan with a little bit of water in it, versus the ocean is a huge stock pot full of water. It just takes a while, no matter how high you turn up the burner, to get that pot of water to warm up. And that's basically why we see the lag in warming when we put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, because the ocean can only warm up so quickly. And that's what causes the lag.
That makes sense. So in your paper, you quote former U.S. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu saying, and I'll quote that, it may take 100 years to heat up this huge thermal mass so it reaches a uniform temperature. The damage we have done today will not be seen for at least 50 years, unquote. Now, I found plenty more like that. Is this a long-running misconception? And if it is, how has it shaped climate negotiations and government responses?
There's two sides to this. I mean, what we found is that after you release a pulse of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, there's a lag in its effect, and the atmosphere warms up with a delay of about a decade. But then a lot of that warming does stick around for a really long time, for more than 100 years. And so the idea that our carbon dioxide emissions today will affect our children and our grandchildren isn't wrong. Because the effects of carbon dioxide are quite persistent. What is different is just this idea that the actions that we take will also affect us during our lifetimes. I think people are used to thinking about decisions on the order of just 10 years down the future. So what the result shows is that not only will our children and our grandchildren benefit from an avoided emission, but the person who actually avoids that emission will benefit as well.
So reading through your paper, it was a fast education on some of the hardest issues of climate change, and in particular, I'm thinking of the uncertainty faced when trying to calculate how fast CO2 can become most active. I'd like to look at those one at a time, if we could, starting with the uncertain role of the carbon cycle. Could you talk to us about that?
So carbon cycle uncertainty has to do with the different sinks of carbon in the Earth system, as well as how quickly those sinks can interact with the atmosphere. So when we release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, immediately different systems start to take up that carbon dioxide. The ocean takes up a huge chunk of it eventually. Also, the terrestrial biosphere takes up carbon dioxide. And so what the uncertainties are are what's the capacity for these different systems to take up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and how quickly can they do that?
And then climate sensitivity, it's a huge question. I interpret that as we're not sure what level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will trigger things like fast glacier melting or the permafrost exhaling more CO2. Did I get that right?
So the things you mentioned are things that depend on climate sensitivity. Climate sensitivity itself is a measure we use when we're simulating the climate that indicates sort of the magnitude of the effect of a change in concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. So technically how it's usually measured is you start with a simulation of the climate from the pre-industrial climate before we started emitting a lot of things to the atmosphere. And then you instantaneously double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And there's no carbon cycle in these modeling simulations, so all of that carbon dioxide just stays in the atmosphere permanently. Then we wait for the oceans to warm up and for the climate to re-equilibrate, stabilize at a new temperature, and that temperature change is usually indicative of the climate sensitivity of a given climate model.
Well, we talked about the long-standing misconception that carbon going up now will take at least a generation to affect the climate. But I also, researching this, came across a school of scientific thought led by Matthews and Solomon's 2013 paper saying our past emissions do not determine future warming. And that's a tricky problem to explain. Could you help us understand what that debate is?
Well, I think that Matthews and Solomon were also trying to push back a little bit against this idea that the benefits from emissions cuts will only accrue to future generations. And so what they were showing in that perspective piece that they wrote in Science in 2013 was that the decisions we make about emissions and climate change mitigation policies this century will have effects on temperature trajectories this century. The assumption they made in that, this sort of simple analysis they did for that perspective, is that actually there's no lag between warming and emissions. And that's just a very simple assumption that they made, which is a little inconsistent with a lot of the other information you find out there, but is probably not any worse than the other types of assumptions we found that, you know, the effect is delayed by 30-40 for 50 years. And I guess this was actually one of the papers that really motivated us when we decided to look into this question, because it's a huge contrast to this idea that there's actually a much longer lag. And so we asked ourselves, well, what is the time until the maximal effect of a carbon dioxide emission? And we said to ourselves, oh, someone must have written this paper because it's so obvious. And so we looked for the paper, and we looked and we looked, and it turned out that no one had written this paper before. So we said, oh, let's take the best data that's available right now and try and estimate what that timing is and what the uncertainty associated with it is. So this paper that you referenced definitely was one element of what led us to do this study.
Now, on the subject of time lag, and this isn't really in your paper, but it's something I'm hoping you can help me with. Following that Matthews and Solomon paper, an excellent science blogger named John Cook said bluntly, there is no warming in the pipeline. Nothing is baked in. And yet, my understanding is from people like Dr. James Hansen, he talks about up to 1 degree or more in the pipeline because of either heat stored in the oceans yet to come out or because of global dimming, that aerosol pollution that diminishes the sun hitting the earth. Is there a warming in the pipeline beyond the 10-year lag that you found in your research?
Well, when you start talking about things like aerosols, which aren't accounted for in our analysis at all because we purely isolated the effect of carbon dioxide with this analysis, then it's definitely true that there's a huge cooling effect associated with anthropogenic aerosols in the atmosphere, and that they're counteracting the effects of greenhouse gases to a great extent right now. And while our greenhouse gas emissions are expected to continue to increase for the foreseeable future, under business as usual scenarios at least, aerosol concentrations are absolutely expected to start to peak within the next decade or so and then start to go down. And so as we see that happening in a more, you know, realistic scenario or in the real world, then absolutely a bunch of this warming that would be associated with the greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere and that has been masked by these anthropogenic aerosols reflecting sunlight back into space or creating more clouds, a lot of that warming will start to manifest itself.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Stanford scientist Catherine Rickey, talking about the paper Maximum Warming Occurs About One Decade After a Carbon Dioxide Emission. Well, Kate, in a well-written article at Climate Central, Andrew Friedman found scientists who temper your discovery for several reasons. Some say the timing doesn't matter. All that matters to the climate system is the total greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, whenever that comes. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it depends on what you care about in terms of what it means for something to be important. First of all, from an impact standpoint, there's a good case to be made that it's not the maximum effect that's the important thing, but the persistence of the warming associated with CO2. And that depends on the impact you're interested in. Some impacts do scale pretty closely with the warming effect from CO2. That's things like heat waves or extreme precipitation. And these things are significant impacts associated with climate change and can cause a lot of damage. On the other hand, there's impacts like sea level rise from melting ice sheets or ecosystem die-off. And for those types of impacts, it's the persistence of the warming effect that really makes a big difference, because probably, you know, one hot year isn't going to kill off the forest, you know, in your backyard. But 20 hot years in a row, yeah, that's probably not so good for the existing ecosystem. So it really does matter how long the warming lasts. The other point is just, I think that the 10 years does make a difference in the way that we think and we talk about climate change. Like I said, the results from our analysis are taken from the models that were used to make projections for the last IPCC report. So we haven't changed anything about the physics in this analysis. We just did the analysis such that we could isolate the effect of a single emission. And I think the difference it makes is just showing that that maximum effect occurs on a timescale that I'm thinking about. I think psychologically, the idea that something's going to happen 10 years down the road as opposed to 40 years down the road makes a big difference for a lot of people. And I think it makes a difference to people like politicians as well, because it means the people that are voting for you right now will also benefit from a potentially costly policy decision.
Well, and I think it matters to us personally, too. I mean, if I'm driving my crappy gas-guzzling car and I think, well, it's not going to affect me while I'm alive, but then I find out, oh, yeah, in 10 years, that carbon's going to come back to bite me. Maybe I'll try a bike or public transit.
I think so. I think it makes a difference to me. It's made a difference to a lot of people that I've talked to about this paper. It's just a time scale that I think we're a lot more used to thinking about things on just 10 years down the road.
You know, after reading your study, I was left wondering how long a particular carbon emission can stay active in the atmosphere. I talked to this a little bit with David Archer a couple of years ago, and he's saying, well, the CO2 that you put up there, the exact molecules that you put up there won't stay there because they'll be recycled through the biosphere, but the additional level that you've added will stay there for 50,000 years, 100,000 years maybe, but your graphs appear to stop after 100 years. Was that due to the uncertainty that you had, or why did you cut it off at that point?
Yeah, we decided to cut off our analysis at 100 years just for purely practical reasons. Like I said, the idea behind the study was very much to anchor the results in what was available, the best available data from these large modeling ensembles. Some of the simulations only went for 100 years, so we decided, oh, we'll just do the analysis for as long as we have data from all our data sources. Yeah, it's well known that a significant fraction of that carbon dioxide, once you've emitted it, sticks around for a very long time. So we would expect a significant fraction of that warming to persist for hundreds of years.
Now, as we wrap up, I want to ask you a favor. If you could explain in terms for a layperson what happens to that puff of carbon dioxide that you've been studying, let's say it comes out of the tailpipe for a car or out of our furnace or something, how long does it take to rise into the atmosphere? Does it change chemically? How high does it go? What happens to it?
So carbon dioxide doesn't chemically react very much with things in the atmosphere. That's one of the reasons it's so persistent. Unlike methane, which actually eventually becomes carbon dioxide if it hasn't precipitated out of the atmosphere, CO2 tends to stay CO2 when it's in the atmosphere. The troposphere, or the lower layer of the atmosphere that we live in, is convectively unstable. So it's very turbulent, and that's why we get a lot of weather down here near the surface of the Earth. It basically just means that it's warmer near the ground than it is higher up. And so we get a lot of mixing in the troposphere. And so, yes, CO2, when we emit it, it tends to mix up pretty quickly, which is why, since it's sticking around, why CO2 is such a global pollutant. It's not like these tropospheric aerosols that get emitted near a power plant and the majority of that pollution stays in that region. It's truly a transboundary pollutant that if I emit it here in the U.S., it's going to affect people all over the world. And so basically how CO2 exits the atmosphere is through those types of systems I was talking about earlier. Some of it gets taken up by forests and things like that and sequestered in new biomass. Some of it gets dissolved into the ocean, and that's what causes what people call ocean acidification. And over very, very, very long time scales, geologic weathering and things like that ends up eventually taking extra CO2 out of the atmosphere. But that's something that, like Dave Archer was talking about, it takes, I think, tens of thousands of years is the time scale for that.
Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Catherine Rickey, a postdoctoral research scientist for the famous Carnegie Institute for Science at Stanford University. Her new paper is Maximum Warming Occurs About One Decade After a Carbon Dioxide Emission, published in Environmental Research Letters on December 2nd. It's a groundbreaking new look at the speed of impacts from carbon dioxide and pushing the results of pollution into our own near-term future instead of a coming generation. You can find links to all that in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Kate Rickey, it has been a pleasure learning from you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.